Hello and welcome to episode 27 of series 5 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. Welcome again to the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you're a new listener, you will find over 100 episodes available at our website, which is thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. If you go to the website and you click on the podcast tab, you will see all of the podcast episodes going back all the way to 2020, which you can listen to, consume there. And that's where you'll get the best listening experience, regardless of which platform you're listening on now. On the website, we have links on our show notes. We have a full show note for each episode. And we also have links to our guests and any media that they reference in their interviews itself. Also on the website, you'll find links to our products and our services, our visual communication tools, our explainer videos, and our other internal communications products. So that's the best place to visit if you are new to the show or if you want to get the full podcast experience. Anyway, let's move into the topic for this episode's interview. I used to work with a client that had its own version of the PDCA cycle. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, used properly, the PDCA cycle is plan, do, check, act. So that was something that, they used as part of their continuous improvement and process improvement. But actually what had happened within their organization is they changed the name of it to plan, do, complicate, abandon. And that was indicative of the fact that what they found they were doing is that any programs or the programs that they had were just becoming overly complicated and unwieldy and eventually abandoned and forgotten. So I'm interested to explore that topic in more detail, particularly from an internal comms perspective of what are some of the things that we do overcomplicate and then end up abandoning and which form blocks within our organization to us actually being able to achieve what it is that we're trying to do. So today's guest is going to tell us all about some of those organizational blockages that we encounter. He's going to be covering topics like strategy, steering, decision-making, ownership, teamwork, and meetings. And we're particularly going to do a deep dive into strategy and what that actually means. How do we communicate? How do we develop strategies that our employees understand and that ultimately drive actions within our organization? And that's a key part of any internal communicator's roles within an organization. So that's one of the things we're going to be exploring, and we're also going to be looking at some of the kind of day-to-day human issues that we invariably find within organizations which form blockages. So this episode's all about how do we unblock our organizations from a strategic and communications perspective. My guest today is Jurriaan Kamer. Jurriaan is a Dutch organizational change expert focusing on the application of modern methods to unblock organizations and improve their outcomes. He helps leaders to make more impact by eliminating ineffective strategy, pointless meetings, bureaucratic structures, and slow decision-making. He's been in and around some of the most radical and adaptive organizations globally, including ones without managers and with high levels of autonomy. Over the last decade, Jurriaan has worked as a speaker, author, and consultant, and he co-founded Unblock, which is a modern management consultancy which works with leaders worldwide. So hello, Jurriaan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. And I've let the cat out of the bag in terms of the fact that you're Dutch. So you're in the Netherlands at the minute. Tell our listeners which part of the Netherlands you're in at the moment.
Yeah, so I live in Utrecht, which is less than half an hour from Amsterdam, which is the place that most people know when they think about the Netherlands.
Yeah, most people who don't know the Netherlands, it's like England or UK. Sort of, you live near London. Well, actually, no, I don't. I live quite a long way from London, but yeah, it's usually the capitals are usually the point of reference, aren't they? Tell us a little bit about your work and also your book, because I believe you've just launched recently in the last year a book. Tell us a little bit about that, Jurriaan, and also a bit of a background to how you've ended up doing what you're doing.
Yeah. So sure. So I have a background in IT actually. From a young age, I was fascinated by computers and technology, and spent some time studying computer science. But over time, I became increasingly fascinated with human problems rather than IT problems, and in particular the organizational challenges that we sometimes face. Humans are capable of doing amazing things when they come together and organize themselves. There's no species on Earth that is able to put a man on the moon or to catch a rocket from midair. Like there's lots of things that we can do as large groups of humans, but it requires some intentional thinking and agreement making. So yeah, I became fascinated by that. And I've just, like you said, I've just released my second business book, which is called Unblock. Mm-hmm. Subtitle is Clear the Way for Results and Develop a Thriving Organization. And it's really a practical guide for leaders that are ambitious, that they really know what they want, but somehow they're facing organizational blockers. They feel that things are not happening, and the organization in itself is probably the main impediment to achieving their success.
Mm. Yeah. And I think anyone who's kind of familiar with large organizations where they work for them or with them or is familiar with that idea. So when we're talking about blocked then, for many people that will be fairly obvious, but what are we talking about? What does blocked look and feel like in an organization where it's blocked? What might be some of the indications that there's blockages in that organization, Jurjen?
Yeah, and I think definitely for large organizations, people understand almost intuitively what a blocked organization looks like. But also for smaller organizations, they can be blocked because there's often lack of clarity. There's a lot of ambiguity. But in general, things are just moving so slow, or not moving at all. And that's a good indicator that something is blocked. So if you're facing, you want to achieve something, but you're not capable. Like on my wall here, I have a poster that I've had it hanging here for years, which says like, I try to be innovative once, but I got stuck in meetings. Like sometimes it's just really hard if you have a great idea to bring it to life in an organization that is blocked, and you're facing lots of layers of approval, layers of management, lots of structures and ways of working that are just not supporting an organization to be constantly moving and quick on their feet.
Yeah. I know you said it does happen with small organizations. I agree. It's not just the sole preserver. I always used to use, when I was talking to organizations around change, and I still do use it, it's like a kind of 2x2 matrix. And it's kind of one axis is leadership and one is management. Mm-hmm. And what you tend to find is that, it's kind of organizations tend to start out with a lot of leadership and not a lot of management. They're kind of winging it. They're kind of doing, kind of bootstrapping and just flying by the seat of their pants. And then when they get to a certain size or a certain, it's not all size related, but sometimes it can be kind of like, they can become more grown up and more serious. They kind of introduce all of this management stuff, which you need, you need to get that. You need repeatability and certainty. But it kind of, it's when that tips into high management and low leadership that you get that kind of feeling of we just can't do anything because we've just created so many kind of blockages. So I guess it's kind of a more detailed in depth analysis of what some of those sort of things that we put in our way when we kind of create these organizations inadvertently often, but it will be still very powerful, aren't they?
Yeah, it's like in my book, I use the metaphor of the feeling of swimming through peanut butter.
Yeah.
I think in English, you say treacle, right? As a
swimming. Yeah. But peanut butter still has a similar sort of, even more viscous than treacle. But yeah.
And then peanut butter in itself is delicious. But if you have to swim through it, you won't go very fast and it
rapidly
just feels
loses
like,
its appeal.
Yeah, exactly. So and I think it's about this feeling of things being solid, solidified, and not being reviewed. Like so often, there's a process that we introduce, or a rule, or something else, or a form, And it's like that was introduced for a really good reason at one point in time. Like somebody thought, well, maybe next time we do this, we don't want to make this mistake again. So now we're going to put a small little process in place, and that will really help us get the outcome we want. Mm. However, those things are often not revisited. And when I often use the metaphor of like if you look in an average kitchen drawer, you'll quickly notice that people are great at accumulating things.
Yeah.
But terrible at throwing stuff away.
Yeah.
Like I have four bottle openers in my drawer and I'm not going to throw any of them away, but I only need one, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. No, they're hoarders of things and systems and processes. You're absolutely right there. And these things very rarely get challenged. And there's all these kind of legacy things that just sometimes are incompatible with each other as well, which is where it becomes another challenge. So in the book, and I know in your, as part of your work, you kind of talk about these six blockers, and we'll kind of run through these. And I always apologize in advance to listeners who are listening to an audio podcast for giving them a list, because it's kind of like, unless you're very good, you've got a good memory or a very good visual ability to kind of visualize these lists. So we will put these into the show notes for people. But if we can maybe run through them, and I know we're going to kind of look, we're going to really obviously give them the audience to sort of drill into around strategy and comms in a lot more detail. But let's kind of give them a kind of heads up on what these six areas are, Yuri. And so the first one is strategy. So you want to tell us a little bit more about how strategy can become a blocker, or how strategy can become blocked in an organization. Yeah.
So that's the first one. Indeed, it's like, so often there's a gap between strategy and action. There's a gap between ambitions from leaders and the impact that they're actually making. Mm. And often we think about all sorts of things, all sorts of reasons for that. And maybe sometimes communication and better and more communication is the solution. Mm. However, it's often the strategy itself that is problematic. Mm. It could be, and we can dive deeper into that indeed. Like it's either a detailed wish list or a high level, broad, fluffy cloud of words. That and both don't create alignment and focus at scale, which is ultimately the job of strategy.
So
that's how I would summarize that one.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that, because we're going to do a deep dive into that. So the next, so that's the strategy, your first one. The second is steering. Tell us a little bit more about steering.
Yeah, so steering is about having mechanisms for setting goals and following progress, but also about integrating feedback loops in how you work. So if you learn that something isn't working, that you're able to change your goal and do something else, right? So often we fixate our goals on the whole year, and only at the end of the year, closer to the end of the year, we look at them again, like, oh, what did we agree on last year? But the fast, more adaptive organizations, they set a rhythm, a cadence of 30 or 60 or 90 day goals, and constantly find the right things to measure. So so that's what steering is about, and unblocking steering is about.
Okay, so we've covered strategy, we've covered steering, and then the third one is decisions. So tell us a little bit more about decisions and why decision making is a key blockage or potential for blockage within organizations, Yurian.
Yeah, so everything an organization does or doesn't do is the result of a decision. So it's vital. It's basically the lifeblood of organizations. Mm. But we often find ourselves in meeting after meeting after meeting trying to get a decision, or we're trying to figure out who's actually the decision maker here, who can actually cut this thing and decide that it is the thing we're going to do or not do. Mm. In the book I offer all sorts of ways to distinguish reversible from irreversible decisions, so we can make them a lot faster. And I also offer ideas to make better decisions faster with more inclusion, which almost sounds like a fairy tale, but it's possible.
Yeah. No, I like that. I agree with you. It's one of those things that I think that organizations just think, well, you know, kind of decision making, it's kind of one of those things that you just do. But I do think one of the things I've covered in the past when I've been, you know, particularly when I've been facilitating with clients, is to sort of be really clear on how we're going to make a decision, because it's okay to make a unilateral, you know, kind of autocratic decision in a situation that requires it. You know, if it's like, hey, there's a fire in the building, we're all going to get out, that is a legitimate decision making. Equally, there are decisions that need, you know, where no one's got the right answer and you need everybody's involvement because we're kind of doing something that's completely novel and nobody's an expert. And I think being explicit about what method of decision making you're going to use can be really, really powerful, because people are okay when you make those decisions that where it's I'm going to listen to your point of view, but ultimately I'm going to make the decision. So I think it's really explicit about decision making, and as you say, improving the way we make decisions and recognizing the decisions aren't irreversible, and that it, you know, kind of make, I think lots of organizations are completely mired in trying to make perfect decisions. It's a kind of best of the enemy of the good sort of thing, isn't it? Cool. Right. Okay. So we've got number one, strategy. We've got number two, steering. We've got three, decisions. Now we're on to ownership. So tell us a little bit about ownership, Yurian.
Yeah. So when I talk and work with leaders, they often, I would say complain about that people in their organization are not taking ownership, that they don't take the initiative, that they wait for approval, ask for approval from management to do something, and that causes all sorts of problems. in the book, I argue though that it's most of the time it's not the people that are not taking the ownership. It's the organization that's not enabling people to take ownership. So it's all about introducing structures and ways so that people in the organization can always do what is right without needing to wait or needing to approve or being afraid to fail or all sorts of things.
Yeah. There's a lot of pseudo ownership, you know, kind of pseudo empowerment that goes on. Yeah. And then it's often when a crisis or a situation arises when it's like, you know, it's like taking all the toys away from the kids and just sort of I'm the boss now and I'm going to make the decision. And it's kind of, that's for me is the kind of the proof of the pudding when in these sort of situations. So absolutely. True ownership and trust and empowerment, easy to say, hard to do. Excellent. Let's go on to the fifth then. So fifth is teamwork. So tell us a little about your take on teamwork.
I mean, it's obvious that you need good collaboration and good teams to get things done. Mm. The two things that I feel are often missing is psychological safety. Okay. So are people either afraid to speak up or afraid of being ridiculed when they share an early formed idea? Mm. Or is it a place where I can just say what I want and can expect to be received with empathy and don't need to play a role when I go to work and just be myself? And the other thing is that we often see teams stuck in the same old way and don't spending the necessary time to reflect and improve. Mm. And I know you're a big Formula One fan, but Formula One teams are an example of an organization that are just really good at this. They've built in moments of reflection throughout the week, throughout the weekend, and they're doing it at every level, hoping to gain 1/100th of a second per lap.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and I totally, we've done a lot of recordings recently around psychological safety and certainly a topic that people are very interested in at the minute and, you know, kind of how do we build that in, particularly sort of post-pandemic and that kind of sense of recognizing the importance of having people who feel, you know, able to bring their full self to work, I think is really important. So so we've gone strategy, steering, decisions, ownership, teamwork. The final one is meetings. Mm-hmm. So I'm a passionate believer in, I think, what you're about to say, but give us your take on meetings, Yuri.
Yeah, so I don't have to explain what it looks like when you're blocked with your meeting culture. I guess a lot of people can probably have experiences of either being overloaded by meetings, drowning in meetings, or just being through a lot of meetings that are super ineffective and don't get any result. And that has exploded during the pandemic. Like 250% growth in meetings. And for some managers even, it means that they're just spending over 80% of their time in meetings, which feels horrible to me if that's the case.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we still need to meet. We still have to communicate with each other, align with each other, make agreements with each other. And so in the book, I offer a whole bunch of ways to have fit for purpose meetings, meaning that they are designed for a certain outcome, that they're structured in a certain way, that they are facilitated, so that every time you have that meeting, it creates the outcome that you had in mind when you designed the meeting. So it's really about being much more intentional about how you spend your time in meetings with others. And the other thing is about systemic interventions, because we can tell people to decline more meetings themselves or to block off time in their calendars. But if things are not happening on a systemic level, they keep growing back. And there's a quote in my book from Gustavo Rossetti. He says, like, meetings are like mushrooms. If you don't change the environment, they'll just keep popping up and growing back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going back to your kitchen drawer analogy, there's a lot of those kind of redundant utensils in organizations and manifest themselves as meetings, don't they? And I agree with you totally. I mean, I know from a personal perspective, when I look at my diary and it is like, you know, sort of six or seven teams meetings back to back, I know that at the end of that day, I'm going to be more knackered than if I'd, you know, work, you know, kind of purely doing something cerebral that I was working on for myself. And I think they're exhausting. The temptation to just literally cram them in, and the ability of people to put meetings in your diary that you have no kind of knowledge of and have no kind of involvement in designing, I think is a huge drain on people's just psychological energy. And I'm totally with you. And, you know, kind of the whole I know whenever I facilitate a meeting, people are always shocked when I first thing I do is kind of just ask them why we're having this meeting. Yeah. And they all kind of, you know, well, like, we thought we all knew that, or we're just going to talk over this thing. Well, you know, that isn't an objective. That's just the kind of process that, well, what yeah. are we, you know, what's the outcome? What do we walk out the room? Mm-hmm. What would we have achieved? And so, yeah, I'm with you that very, very, very much on that one, Jurrien. Mm-hmm. So, we're going to dial back in, and as we said, we're going to do a deeper dive. So a lot of your work revolves around strategy and, yes. and the importance of strategy. And then I know, obviously, for the audience, that we were going to talk a little bit about communications and the importance mm-hmm. of communication. So just going back into strategy,
yeah,
I think I picked up a couple of things from what you said. One is around kind of definition of, you know, when you and I totally agree with you this, because a lot of our work is around strategy activation. And you know, a client will get us in and say, yeah, we've got this our new strategy and we need to kind of, and I'm going, okay, so the strategy is finished. Yeah, it's all finished. Don't you need to, you won't be changing the strategy. It's done. We just need you to help us to kind of activate it within the organization. Yeah. And I always say to them, I can guarantee as part of this process, you will want to revisit your strategy once mm-hmm. we think about how we're going to activate it, because you'll recognize it's got holes in it and it maybe isn't, you know, I don't actually say that, you'll probably recognize it isn't actually a strategy. But, and I know that's kind of for you is one of the key things, is actually being really clear on what we're talking about when we're talking about strategy. So let's maybe start with what's your definition of what a strategy should be, but then also, how does that then get conflated within organizations and mixed up with all sorts of other things, and then, you know, potentially yeah. vanillaized into something that's utterly meaningless and doesn't really inspire any or guide any action, which is ultimately what a strategy should do? What's your position on that, Jurrien?
Yeah, so strategy is an integrative set of choices that improves your chances of winning in a certain playing field.
Mm.
So that's a very different definition from the definition I derive from what I often see in the world, which is the list of things we as leaders need to do.
Mm, yes.
we as leaders feel you should do for us, right? You know, it's a very, very one directional thing. It's like we have the knowledge, but you know, so it starts, if it needs to be a strategic set of choices, an integrative set of choices, it also means that it is, first of all, it means that you can be wrong.
Mm.
So and that's scary. So you know, I see strategies where leaders are not making a choice and not saying we're not going to do that. We're just going to do. So that's the first thing. Like it should be punchy in a way that you can be wrong. It can be tested, and which means that if it's false, you should revisit it, and you shouldn't wait for the next strategy cycle to revisit it because you don't want to change it. Right? It's really about being adaptive when you face the circumstances and when you're testing things.
Yes.
The other thing is like, if you want it to be a plan for overcoming obstacles, it means that you first have to be aware of what are the things that are currently hindering us from being the winner in this market or whatever your strategy is. It doesn't need to be commercial, but it's just easy to say, like, if you want to be the biggest player in a certain industry, so what are the things that you currently have or don't have that allow you or enable you to achieve that?
Yeah.
And your strategy should be a set of choices that allows you to overcome those obstacles so that you can actually improve the chances of winning. Mm. So that's the first thing. And I think, that's just it often is missed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I often, I'm a Formula One fan, I'm also a football fan. Mm-hmm. And I always, when I'm talking to clients who kind of, you know, have come, they've maybe just got a long list of KPIs and that's their strategy, or it's kind of something like, you know, we will be number one in our market, it's often again conflated with vision and we want to be number one in our market. And I always say, well, name one company that doesn't, you know, want to be, you know, position itself as high up in the market. So I always use the kind of football analogy, and I always say, look, you know, imagine this is a Premier League, you know, that there are teams in the English Premier League who are clearly got a chance of winning it, and there are teams that have clearly got no chance of winning it. For some, it's like, we will finish mid-table is their strategy, and they develop a bunch of tactics and recruitment models and investment and finance and all of the things that they are going to need in order to be able to realistically sustain that. And for them, that is, you know, that's their strategic actions. That's their strategic plan. And they've got a clear vision of them, you know, and it's a little bit like a lot of companies, you know, sort of, we're going to win the Premier League, but you haven't got the resources, you haven't got the customers, you're coming from a base where you're not going to be able to, and you really haven't thought through what it will need to win your Premier League, as it were. So I totally agree with you. It's kind of often well-intended, you know, ambitious. It's a misdirected ambition, I think, that can be a real challenge there. Okay, so that's the kind of definitional thing. What about, let's talk a little bit about what some of the other issues are then with strategy. And I think we you know, we were going to talk around comms and how do we kind of get that message? Because ultimately, you know, everybody in the organization should, you know, I used to work in a food company that was, we did a really good job of activating our strategy every year. So everybody knew why it was really important that we hit certain productivity targets on particular lines, and we got outputs from particular lines, because strategically that was a market that we were really going for that year. And it was either because there was a World Cup or there was another annual event where people were going to be eating those snacks, and we knew that we need to have the capacity to be able to deliver that, and that was going to be a huge uplift in sales. I mean, everybody from the people who swept the floors, the people who kind of worked in the canteens, knew that that was a big target for the business, and kind of knew that's why everybody was kind of talking about that. Rarely have I seen that in any other companies I've been in. So what are some of the challenges do you think that organizations face, both in terms of articulating that in a way that everybody can understand, but also in a way that actually people are really interested or engage with with Yurian?
I think what you're saying is really important, because the opposite of what you just described is something that Nilüfer Merchant calls an air sandwich, which means like there's a clear top layer long-term idea of what the company is about, and there's a very detailed bottom layer of things to do and KPIs to hit, but there's nothing in between. So there's like that's why it's called an air sandwich. It's like it's empty sandwich. It's like the fluffy, meaty middle is the thing that teams and people need to internalize what it means. So it's really about talking, why are these choices being made? What's the rationale behind it? So that when you're faced with day-to-day decisions, you can act as if you understand the strategy, not because, so if maybe it's not in your to-do list or it's not in your instructions of what you need to do, but I'm facing a decision here. And so if I don't have this clarity in the middle, I'm going to just go and throw it back to management and say, you know what, I want to decide. So you tell me what to do, and which is not what you want. And in the book, I talk a lot about organizations built on the principle of aligned autonomy. So you want to have teams that are highly autonomous because you're hiring the best talent that you can get from the market, and you don't really want to tell those people what to do. You're hiring professionals that are really capable of deciding not only how they're going to do the job, but what is the most valuable thing they can contribute to today. But the only way they are able to leverage that high level of autonomy if there's also a high level of alignment. And then that's where comms comes in, you know, because if you are working with professionals, they need strategic awareness so to a certain extent, so that they understand if they're facing decisions day to day, and if they are deciding, you know, what are we going to focus on in the next quarter, that by just understanding the strategy, they are able to act and do the right thing every day.
Absolutely. It reminds me, I don't know whether you've ever come across it, Yurian, there's a book by, he's a military historian, he's a guy called Stephen Bungay. He wrote a book called The Art of Action, and he's a kind of a real, you know, student of military history, and I'm always, again, wary of, you know, overlaps with military history and sport. You know, whenever we've used sporting, and I've used sporting analogies, and we talked a little bit about that. And you know, the overlaps with business aren't always, you know, kind of clear or relevant. But he, you know, he talks about the kind of the evolution of, you know, the kind of going back to the sort of, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th, early 19th century, where, you know, kind of armies would march in rows and into kind of cannon fire and just basically, you know, kind of be decimated and eventually maybe just through sheer numbers break through or do whatever they want to do. And then you kind of like, you went through an evolution of what we have now, which are kind of, you know, kind of military units which work in small teams, small units with a defined objective, knowing full well that whatever the plan was, it's not going to survive initial contact with the enemy.
And
you know, that kind of whole sort of understand, adapt, and transform in order to achieve the objective is basically how a lot of those, not just elite units, but mm-hmm. kind of more mainstream units is operating now. And it's that kind of evolution of we know we can't tell you exactly everything that's going to happen when you mm-hmm. get out there, because we don't know what's going to happen ourselves.
Yeah.
But we want you to understand what the objective is, and we trust you, and we've trained you to the point where you can adapt where you need to. And that's ultimate, you know, again, I'm always, as I said, cautious of making analogies with military things, because it's, you know, kind of unpleasant and involves hurting and killing people, but it is essentially, you know, what we're trying to do with our organizations. We don't want to, you know, give everybody a list of things to do and you just slavishly follow those and you kind of just do them and you know, you don't even question it and you invariably fail. You actually kind of know what we're trying to achieve. We've got a broad intent, and you kind of adapt when you get to the where the customer is or whatever. And so I think I totally agree with you there. I mean, one of the things I find, and I'm interested in your point this year, is that often it's a lack of understanding of what those, you know, hills and whatever metaphor we want to use, what those barriers and obstacles that we're going to face are. You know, we don't always tell people, you know, one of the challenges we're going to have here is the customers, this customer we've worked with before, and you know, we didn't do a great job from the past, so we need to be kind of acknowledge that, and we need to adapt around that. It's kind of an lack of understanding of context. Would you agree that that's sometimes a blocker in terms of getting people to understand the strategy? They don't actually understand, you know, the strategic context, as it were, that we're operating within.
Yeah, so often I actually find that the leaders do have that context.
Mm.
They're not sharing it.
Yes,
you know? There's some misunderstanding about, you know, we are we are in the C-suite and we're paid the big bucks, so we should need to make all the most important decisions. And then, so we are hoarding that information, and we shouldn't confuse the people with all that information, right? It's like we shouldn't tell everybody everything because they're just going to get confused.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, I think, especially when you're thinking about teams that are autonomous and that they are able to solve problems on their own without needing direction, what is necessary is for a strategy to be integrated and not cascaded.
Yeah.
And you know, there's many comms teams that I worked with that are really good at drafting the perfect message, making it visible. But it's a bit more, it's almost like manipulation rather than clarification, right?
Mm.
So, and the other thing that is often missed, that if you want to integrate strategy, you need to engage a large group of people and get their perspective.
Mm.
And then integrating what people are telling you based on what you're sharing to their day-to-day realities. Because that's the only way you'll know that the strategy you're deploying is making sense. First of all, like, is it understandable?
Yeah.
Does it influence people's day-to-day decisions? Is it complete? Like, are people telling you that there's actually another huge burning fire in the corner of the organization, but you don't know? And I think, yeah, internal comms teams sometimes have a really big, you know, top-down or one-way broadcast type perspective, rather than facilitation skills. I think if you're really good internal comms teams, you should get really good at facilitating gatherings and integrating messages top to bottom, bottom to top, you know? So
absolutely. I totally agree. I think for me, it's the, you know, and again, this is no disrespect to internal comms people. A lot of them have come from media or journalistic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. It's less, you know, it's changing. There's people coming into the profession now, I think, who are choosing it as a profession, not as a kind of a follow on from things they may have done earlier in their career that have kind of led them into kind of content creation. But I do agree with you. I think facilitation is a key skill to develop, I think, for any internal comms person. I think it's a key skill for any manager or leader, but particularly for internal comms people to think about, how do we kind of facilitate understanding and learning and meaning rather than how do we communicate a message? Because that, you know, no matter how good you are at communicating that message, it will still be through all of your filters and prejudices and biases and all your kind of mental filters. You will still not have the same impact as someone understanding what we're trying to achieve, understanding their role, assimilating it into their work. And one of the things we use, which is quite helpful in that is giving people scenarios and dilemmas. So a day-to-day plausible working scenario where there's a kind of a trade-off between two equally justifiable decisions. Mm-hmm. Use our strategy to help you decide which of those is the best thing to do and how you would deal with it. And in a way that's complied, that supports our strategy and helping them through that thought process and working at, and showing their workings as they go through, it can be a really good way of them kind of going, I get it now. I know what it is we're trying to do. And I understand, in, you know, and maybe it's not that situation, but in a similar situation, or I can kind of make that decision for myself now. And I think we rarely do. I see organizations doing that really, really well. So
There's one practice that we often use for that, which is even overstatements.
Yeah.
So those are like simple heuristics that you can use. Like, maybe it's sustainability even over profit is an example I often use. So if that is the strategy, like we're really going to double down on sustainability and we just going to agree that we care a little bit less about profit, that gives everyone permission to make the sustainable choice even over the profitable choice when they're facing day-to-day questions.
Yeah.
There's a big opportunity for comms teams to clarify those trade-offs with the people that are trying to communicate and to create simple heuristics to help guide localization and local decision-making.
I agree. I totally agree. Again, going back to my food company previous employer who were really good at this, and they did that through kind of stories that they would encourage people to tell. So they're one of their famous stories that I remember, even though I wasn't there when this happened, but it was one of the kind of ones of these, one of these kind of, you know, sort of fables that guests passed down the organization, was a time when they had there was a potato chip factory. They had a bad harvest of potato chips. Mm-hmm. The chips weren't very good, you know, the potatoes weren't very good quality, so they struggled to make chips of the quality. So there was a dilemma there about, do we hit orders and make money, or do we kind of actually fail some of our orders because we can't make the product to the sufficient mm-hmm. quality that the customer wants? And the decision was, we will fail orders because we are not sending out substandard product.
Yeah.
And they took the rap, you know, there was a dip in profit and turnover for that particular quarter, but that was symbolic of, we will always put quality before cost, before, you know, profit. And that story, you know, is one that got told and people remembered it and it got passed along the generations, as it were. And I think, is it similar to your example there? I think, you know, creating those sort of trade-off dilemmas and showing this is what we, you know, and actually then the trick is, going back to some of the things we talked about earlier around ownership, I guess, is then backing people up when they make those decisions and not kind of go, why did you do that? You know, it's okay to question, but then go, great, your logic was right, and that was exactly the right thing to do. Is a good leadership technique.
And I think so often when communicating strategies, we are reinforcing the hierarchy, especially if you do it in a traditional way where top executives invite the top 50 of the organization and leans on them, you know, communicating it further, like a telephone game, you know, the broken telephone.
Yeah.
And then when it reaches the people that are doing the work, that are actually creating the value for your customers, that are, they are like, oh yeah, here's the strategy deck again. Yeah, it looks a lot like last year's. And I don't know how this affects me. I'll just keep on doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, that's a huge waste of time and energy. So I would really invite people not to do it. The tools these days, not only the facilitation techniques, but also the technical tools, are there to engage everyone. You know, you can go and do digital summits where you invite people to share perspectives, to let them shape the strategy. Giving people the opportunity to shape the strategy is the best way for them to adopt the strategy, actually.
Yeah.
So it's not about communication. It's about integrating it into my reality and really unpacking that meaty middle of the air sandwich so we know what it means.
Yeah.
It's creating meaning and sense making. That's what it is.
Absolutely. Well, look, we're coming towards the end of this conversation, Yuri. And just before we kind of wrap up, I mean, any final thoughts around that? I think you've given us some fantastic insights there. Any other kind of final thoughts? I know there's no quick tips in this sort of an area like this, but any other final sort of provocations or thoughts that you'd like to leave listener with in terms of particularly around strategy and communication and that old air sandwich piece, which I really like that analogy.
Yeah. So one thing I would say, like, I want to challenge the default time horizon of many strategic plans. Somehow we're fixated on the 1-year plan, And that creates some unhelpful dynamics. There's a couple of companies out there that are doing it really differently. They say, you know what, we're going to plan long term. Sometimes it's very long term, but I used to land on 2 to 3 years because people highly overestimate what they can do in 1 year, but they underestimate what they can do in 2 to 3 years. So if you put a stake in the ground, like in 2 to 3 years, we really want to be here, or we want to master this and that so that we can win in the market, that the strategy becomes a lot more inspiring rather than fluffy and too concrete. So if you give it 2 to 3 years, it gives people the space to navigate, and then also encourage people to plan in 90-day cycles. So plan long-term and short-term, but nothing in between. Because the world, like you said, like the moment the plan hits reality, it changes, it's not working. So, but this long-term thing, that long-term ambition is probably going to stay fixed for a while. But so that's the final thing I would say. And then to add on that is, what if, you know, given that is our 90-day outcome that we're facing, like what is something that is safe to try? And that touches upon ownership and also decision making, where it's like, what is the experiment that I can do that is safe, that will help us learn something, and that help us validate something, and that we don't have to, you know, bicker about and meet about for months and months to make one decision. Like, let's design a safe to try experiment or project that will really help us move the needle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, here on both of those, but particularly on that first one around, you know, kind of showing that this isn't just, I think the annual cycle thing within organizations, you know, we're only going to follow this strategy for a year, which is just crazy, really, because that isn't, you know, that kind of automatically for me would say, well, is it really a strategy then? Or is it, and showing that there's some longevity. And again, I think there's an acknowledgement within that, that however we will learn and we will adapt. So it may change around the margins, but essentially our intent is that we recognize that we need to kind of keep this course, and we need to be brave, and we need to, you know, kind of weather some of the storms, and unless it's patently not working for a whole bunch of reasons and we're going in a really bad direction, we will stick to it, but we will also communicate any deviations from course with you, and I think that's something else that organizations don't always do. They don't always you mentioned it earlier around stop doing things that aren't working. You know, I facilitate certain types of things, I do the kind of stop, start, continue, and the start and the continue lists are really long, and the stop is so there's barely anything on it. And you think, well, hang on, you're not going to start all this stuff, because unless you're going to hire about another 100 people, you're going to run out of resources, or you're going to have really long working days. So definitely. Well, look, that's been really, really fascinating, Yuri. And I love talking to you. You've got so many kind of similar experiences, it sounds. What I'm going to do though is just for the listeners, I mentioned, you know, your six blockers, and we'll put those into the show notes. I'm going to put some links in for people to reach out and connect with you. So I was going to put your LinkedIn profile and also your website as well, which is www.unblock.works. I've just realized as well, I've not got it in the list of things I put in our kind of interview plan, was also a link to your book as well. So is that available on pretty much your usual sources, or is there any kind of place you would direct people to buy a copy of the book?
Yeah, so the book is on Amazon, and the quickest way to get there is www.unblockbook.net.
Yeah.
Or just type in Unblock and my name and you'll find it on Amazon.
And we'll put that link into the show notes as well, Yurian. So look, been fantastic speaking to you, Yurian. Thank you so much. By the time this interview goes out, we will know whether Max has won the world championship again, or whether it's Lando has managed to pull off the unthinkable and overhaul his points. But enjoy the rest of the season, and obviously we won't be far away from the start of the next season by the time this hits our listeners' ears. But at the time of recording, we're in a very exciting period of the Formula One season. I know we're both fans, so
yes.
It's been lovely speaking to you, Yurian, and thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a really good chat.
Brilliant. Take care, Yurian. All the best.
You too.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you've got any ideas for episodes you'd like us to cover in future, you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can use the feedback form at engagingic.com. If you're not already subscribed to the show via your podcast platform, please do so. And if you could leave a review for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. We have links to other episodes at engagingic.com. All of our previous episodes are available there. And if you're interested in our visual communication services, our big pictures, our learning maps, our explainer videos, and also our live graphic recording, please get in touch with us again at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. Thank you.